Well, for this talk, there's a special greeting. Good afternoon, guinea pigs. I'm trying to do a different outlook in these talks on astrology. I'm trying to get to some things about the desire world. The last three talks in the series, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, will have many, many horoscopes. And some of them will be horrible horoscopes. But in building up to that, there are some things I want to get to that are not easy to get to. At least that's the way I found out for it. I'm at such an age now where I'm trying to, I think different things in your spiritual consciousness come awake at different ages. And as I see things now, unification and synthesis and harmonization and working together as one is becoming very, very important to me. It's what I really care about now. Universe means one. It means that unless we see things as one, or unless we see things as a whole, we have a very incomplete outlook on the cosmos. And when you're younger, different things catch your attention, and all of humanity in some ways is very young. So that a lot of our human endeavors are specialization. We specialize in this, and we specialize in that, and that takes one away from universal spiritual consciousness. Now, we're in the depths of materialism. We're about as deep as we go into matter. And in matter, the more materialized things are, the more specialization is necessary. That's why we come here, is to see things in separate, special ways and not to see them as part of universal wholes. So to some extent, specialization is the order of the day, and it's like the farmers say about this time of the year, you make hay when the sun shines. And that's the hay that we're making. However, because we have fallen in the way that we have fallen, our humanity has chosen to go so deeply into matter that we have closed ourselves off from intuition, from the realms of greater unification. And we've carried this so far that our consciousness is at a breaking point about it. It's very dangerous to be too highly separated and specialized. If one doesn't have a flow going through from the universal spirit, that's a dangerous place to be in. Even separation in little things can prove to be problematic. The separation and specialization show up first in our psychology. So without getting too much into that, we see that psychological problems are almost endemic in the United States as we become more and more separated and specialized. So synthesis is extremely important. Trying to see universal wholes is very important, and that's going to take up a lot of what we talk about today. We talk for today and tomorrow, though tomorrow will be significantly different. It's two parts of a talk that is called Mood and Psychology. And we're going to define our own use of those terms, but that's the way things are. Now, you would think that it wouldn't be the case that even astrology is prone to the dangers of separatism. That's ironic, because if you're dealing with a science that is about the whole universe and our relationship to the whole universe, you wouldn't expect that kind of specialization to be taking place. But it does happen. Specialization and separation in astrology is there, and it occurs in a different sort of way than it does in material science. And so the problem in material science is that material science is shallow. That doesn't mean that there aren't concentrated people that probe deeply into things. It means that it's shallow in that it only touches the material surface and not the realms of meaning that are behind the realms of form. The problem of astrology is a little bit of a different kind of a problem. And that problem is has to do with symbolism. Astrology works through symbolism, and symbolism was never necessary in the cosmos at all. Things stood for what they were, and by seeing things for what they were, the truth that was in them was lived out. But when we fell into matter, and we lost clairvoyance, we lost spiritual vision, and we even lost quite a bit of our intuitive consciousness. When that happened, we still had a need to be in touch with the spiritual worlds. So what was instituted was symbolism. And a symbol is a material artifact. It's a material thing that stands for something else that is unseen. It is a way, it's something like a doorway or a portal between the outer material world and the inner spiritual world. And we have all kinds of symbolism. We have mythology, we have even a lot of our art is symbolic. But there are problems with astrology and the symbolism that is astrology right now, and that is it's becoming archaic. We're at a time in our evolutionary history that we should be looking at the spiritual reality straightforward. We should be putting much more attention on developing the spiritual vision so that we can see into other people's character and see them for what they are and appreciate what they are. So symbols are materialistically limiting. The ancient wise people said a symbol reveals or conceals as much as it reveals. If we take the astrological mandala, which is a very gigantic symbol. This one isn't complete. It doesn't have the planets and the aspects on it. One of those projects I haven't finished for about 25 years. But it's an extremely complex symbol, and it represents the whole universe. And even though it is a very wonderful and a very flexible symbol, it's pretty limited. You know, you look at this wall, that doesn't look like the whole universe, and even if you're doing a lot of pondering, it doesn't answer the whole universe. So astrology, like many other things in materialism, it's sort of a thing. You know, you've heard the story about horses that find their security in stables. And so when the stable burns down, you have to hold on to the horse because the horse will run back into the stable because that's where it has its security. And the same sort of thing happens with materialism, and especially astrological materialism. If you think about it, we're like in quarantine here. Because of our sinful ways, we have quarantined ourselves in full participation in the greater cosmos. You know, like we don't want the rest of the cosmos to become diseased with our negativity, though it does spread there anyway. But we've gotten to like it here. So much so that we think that this is all there is, and that's a very big failing. The same thing happens in the same way that we escape true spiritual realization by being very content with matter. In a smaller way, what happens with astrology is people escape real life by going into astrology. It's a little world, and you can live in that little world, and since it represents a greater world, you can say, I'm in touch with reality. I had a period in life where I escaped into an even smaller world. I used to play bridge every day. And I would hide myself in the world of bridge, and I wouldn't be in touch with reality. I didn't have any friends or anything. Every hand was like a new lifetime. It had its drama, especially if you didn't have a good partner. It had its drama, and you were living in a world, and it was an escapist kind of world. And astrology can be that kind of world also. So what I'm trying to get at in doing these talks in this way is I'm trying to move away from the symbolism and get more to the feeling of the reality of the spiritual worlds. In this case, we're going to be talking about the desire world, and get at an experience of the desire world in a way that is more direct and not so indirect as it is in symbolism. I guess you could even call it symbolatry. It gets to be like that. So, we're going to focus on the desire world and on the desire body. And for astrology, that is exceptionally important, because astrology, in the way that it works, has a special resonance for the desire world. It applies to the material world, and it applies to the world of thought, but it isn't, you know, just like color relates to the desire world, one relates to it in the sense that one relates to color. It's a special symbiosis. There are colors in the material world, but they aren't as far developed here as they are in the desire world. Similarly, astrological forces work, at least as horoscopy astrological forces, are most in tune with the desire world. And that's what we're going to be trying to work with. Paracelsus, Max Heindel seems to intimate, was an early Rosicrucian student. With his clairvoyance, he saw that the cause of astrology was to be found not in electromagnetism or gravity or anything like that. He found that the astrological forces work through the desire world, and that astrology only really applied in the most direct fashion to creatures that had desire bodies. Boy, I'm way away from my notes here. He was the first one to call the desire world the astral world. It was called that because it was scintillating and shining and sparkling with bright colors, just like the stars are. And so the astral world took that name. The Rosicrucian philosophy does not call it that. It calls the desire world. And this is because in Rosicrucian philosophy, things are named according to what they do and not according to what they look like. And I think this is a very wise way to name things, because it has one living the life and practicing and using, even to hear about it, one is practicing the whole idea of using and doing. Nonetheless, even though the Rosicrucian philosophy calls the desire world the desire world and not the astral plane or something like that, it does recognize that this is where the forces of astrology are most active and most direct in our interaction with them, as far as horoscopes indicating what our desire natures are in response to the cosmic desire body. In some spiritual philosophies, the desire world is called the world of the animals. It's called the world of the animals. In the great Bhava Chakra, it's called the world of the animals. And in fact, the word zodiac means circle of animals or wheel of animals, Zeus, Tycho. But that, I'm very tired, and I'm way away from my notes, and I get some trouble. The reason the desire world is called the world of the animals is because it is the home of the animal root spirits. Seers of all types, especially Western seers, claim that all beings, until they have a threefold spirit, a selfhood, an entity, an individual being, and until that individual being has become indwelling in its vehicles of consciousness or in its bodies, it requires guidance. And that guidance is very direct. And so the Rosicrucian seers find that there are tutelary spirits. And for the animal kingdom, for the different species and groups of animals within a species, those spirits are archangels. They are the intelligence of a group of animals. And it really is intelligence, and it's quite remarkable. Like, for example, you will see the a school of fish, or a covey of birds. And I've tried this numerous times. If you sneak up and you charge at a group of birds, or if you scare a school of fish, they'll all scatter different directions, and they never bump into each other. They never bump into. In fact, in schools of fish, or even sometimes when there are flights of birds, you can see that there is an intelligent pattern to the way that they are all held together in one area or one space of consciousness. So the guidance and the lessons that are brought to the evolving beings, because that's what our evolution is all about, we're brought through condition after condition after condition, and each condition brings out another part of the potential of our spiritual being. And so we need to be brought to different kinds of experiences, and those experiences are brought to different species of animals by group spirits, archangelic group spirits, and those archangelic group spirits work from the desire world. In fact, even in all of this, the group spirits and even the creatures are co-creators. In fact, evolution is a one-way street. Yes, you can retrograde a little bit, but not very far. You may spend one life as a Downs baby or something like that, but you can't really go back and become something like a starfish or something like that. And this is built right, you know, we change the conditions. It isn't, you know, like if the whole atmosphere of the Earth is methane-like, and the whole atmosphere of the Earth is, as it was at one time, anaerobic. There was no oxygen. And the evolving species, in living their lives, produced oxygen. And they changed the whole of the Earth forever and ever, so that you couldn't go back to have most of the creatures be non-oxygen breathing creatures. And so this is what we're part of. We're part of an evolutionary process that is always going forward, and by our own actions we outgrow things in such a way that they're changed that we can't ever go back to what there was before. So the group spirits are taking us through these various different facets of experience. Even we as human beings who have realized our divinity to some small extent by taking the creative force into our own hands, even us, because we are as blind as we are, we require some guidance. And that guidance is brought through the astrological forces working through the desire world. So our motivation, our desire to do things, the feelings that we have about things, the kinds of emotions that we creatively express, all of these are things that are our relationship to the general atmosphere of the desire world. And if you think about it, each of us, let's just talk about animals since we're on the subject of animals. Suppose we have a dog, and that dog is a very frisky dog, and it's a dog that has a very good nose. And let's further suppose that that dog has been penned up for a long time, and then we take that dog out. We take it out without a leash. What would we expect? I've done that, and I guess most of you have already, so you know what I'm talking about. The dog is 100% excitement. And if you watch such a dog and you take it out in nature, it jumps here, and then it jumps there, and it jumps all over the place. Whatever gets its interest, which is usually relayed to it by scent, but whatever gets its interest has it, and it bounds here and it bounds there. Now this is the way that many people approach desire. They have this behavioral impulse, and they have that, and that, and that, and that is what they think desire is all about. Now, in a way, that's correct. It's even so correct that if we read something like the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception, that's the way the desire body is described by clairvoyance. They say that it's constantly changing. The colors are changing, and in a flash, one goes through all kinds of emotions, especially if you're going through a really strong experience. In a flash of a second, you go through a whole cascade of different kinds of emotions. And some people think that that is basically what the desire world and the desire body and the nature of desire is. That's what some people think. I don't think that way. If one does think that way, then one is likely to think that the desire body is just a mass of all kinds of different emotions and feelings and desires and passions and everything else. That's not quite wrong. it is true that we have our all these different things, but it is, really isn't the reality. Our desire bodies are composed of the stuff that we have that make up those feelings and urges and desires, but that's not exactly the way it is. That's a phenomenological approach. It states that the bundle of facts that you have observed is the reality. That's almost just the opposite, or that's the extreme of materialism, phenomenology. It's like the facts are it. Symbolism, at least the bundle of facts that is a complex symbol, opens you up so that you can penetrate through the spiritual worlds to the worlds of meaning that are behind it. But there has to be more than that if you really think about it. So let's go back to the dog and look at the dog some more and try to get at a better picture of things. If we watch the dog, you might see that the dog is interested in the scent of mice or in the scent of pheasants and maybe even some plants that it likes the smell of. And if you watch that dog all day, every day, all of its life, you would write down a list of all of the things that interested the dogs and the thing that didn't. You know, like stones might not interest it, or moss or something like that. You see, oh, that's not in the desire nature of the dog. If you did that, you'd come up with a very refined, you'd have a very big long list, and you would, if you were discriminating, you could describe a dog by that list. Maybe, but cats like the smell of mice, and cats like the smell of pheasants, and cats like the smell of plants. So you need more than a list of likes and dislikes to be able to differentiate a cat from a dog in terms of its desire nature. You can even look at the way a cat is stealthy and the way a dog is stealthy, and it's different for each of them. Sometimes they're very like each other, but they're totally different creatures. What we're trying to get at is that in a species, what differentiates one species from another, and that within which all of those desires, like the desire to jump after a mouthful or something like that, are suspended within a larger consciousness, and that consciousness is relatively constant. A dog is a dog is a dog. It just remains that way forever. That is the desire consciousness, in the case of the dog, of the deep spirit. Such a kind of consciousness which is constant, which within which all of the little things form, and there is a logic to all of those little things. That logic is a psychologic. There is a reason why all of these different feelings follow one after another and the closeness that they bear to each other. But that general emotional state, or that general state in the desire world, that is a dog or is a cat, or for that matter, is Bonnie or Jerry or Darlene, is a mood. Each of us has a desire nature that is our whole, if you're clairvoyant, and you can look beyond all the subtle little changes that happen here and there, now and then, very quickly. If, you know, it's sort of like Proetus and the river god, or the hero and the river god Proetus. The hero needed some information that he could only get from the river god. And so he dove in the river, and he came up in a grotto underground, and he sneaked up and he caught the river god, and the river god is just lounging there in human form. And he reaches up and he grabs the river god, and the river god is really wily. And it turns itself into a lion, and it turns itself into fire, and it turns itself into all kinds of metamorphoses really quickly. And he hangs on and he hangs on, and eventually the river god has to show himself as he is. Max Heindel tells us that's the way clairvoyance is. That in the desire world you can be distracted by this and this and this, just like the dog is distracted by this desire and this emotion, and can be very inconstant. But if you focus and hold your focus and your conscious attention, you eventually see the thing as it is. And I'm sure all of you have had this experience at some time or another, that you've been in a dark room or in a quiet place, and someone you know, you might not even hear them, comes into that space, and you feel the presence of that person, and you know it's that person, and it can't be anybody else but that person. It's because that person is carrying their mood with them. Each of us has a large-scale mood that is ours and ours all alone. We may all do similar things or parallel things with each other, but we each do them with our own rationale. And some of the idiosyncrasies stand out, like, well, there's a lot of Virgo in a horoscope, there's quite a bit of idiosyncrasy in what the world calls peculiar ways of doing things. And if you let the Virgo go, it'll come out just right, because there's a method to that type of accomplishment. All right. You know, you get what I'm trying to say. Now, this is very important in all spiritual matters. Whether you're trying to look through something all the way to the truth of the spirit behind it, or whether you're trying to see what the true general nature is, and that it's not just a quick attitude change, it's very important that you see things as wholes, that you see things as universals. Because all of the other emotions are just expressions of the universal. If we look at particulars and look at particulars in their own right, and not as expressions of the universal, as the phenomenologists look at things, you cannot get at things. In order to get at the truth of things, you have to get the universals. This is obviously a Platonistic universe. When our bodies are created, when the cosmos is created, things come from universals. They may pass into the unknown of the absolute, so that this is a great creative experiment, just as much as it is a great creative expression. It passes into the unknown, and it takes more things from the unknown and brings them into the universal spirit with greater universal consciousness, but the creation passes from universals to particulars. It is a Platonistic cosmos. Now, you can't be partisan about this, and you can't say that there's no place in the world for Aristotelianism, which looks only at individual events, because if you look at particular events and use them to get at the universals that are behind things, that's a perfectly valid thing to do. It is as foolish to try to be a Platonist in our times and ignore science and all of the material things where we study the world as we do now, and from that come to universal conceptions. It's as foolish to be a Platonist as it is to be a pure Aristotelian. All right. Geez, I maybe ought to get on a soapbox here. I'm on a roll with something that I'm not sure is the best place to go. You might say in this regard that science is Aristotelian in that it takes the particulars of life and follows them back to the universe. universals. But art is Platonistic. Art begins with a universal dream, a universal conception of wouldn't it be wonderful, and it proceeds from the universal count of particulars. We'll come back to these universal ideas a little bit later on, and tomorrow especially we're going to talk, we're going to redefine astrology all over again in terms of woods, and all of the principal elements of astrology we're going to look at in terms of wood, because that's the way it's best to experience it. You can't look at a horoscope and look at one little bit of it and think that that's the whole. That's like saying, well, a dog is a mouse lover. What have you said? And a lot of other mouse lovers. And say, you can do the same thing with astrology. All right. We said earlier that we are all co-creators, that there is a parallelism, because the group spirits that guide the different animals and that have the mood of that species, they are evolving too. So that at the same time that a bear is being taken through its bear-like state and doing fishing and eating grubs and the things that bears do, the group spirit in being able to focus on spiritual things and through its desire world impulses while holding that mood is also growing. You know, right now, we're kind of lazy. For us, spiritual exercises are a few minutes a day. You think about the evolutionary work that like our group spirit is doing, it's concentrating on a truth so that it holds that species consciousness centuries. And it gets better in its focus and in its ability to bring its charges through the evolutionary experience. So there's a parallelism, so that when different creatures have had different kinds of experiences and they've taken those lessons as far as they can go, extinction sets in. But then new species are born, usually in times of cataclysm, which means that new group spirits have to learn before, you know, it's like musicians. You play this piece of music, and then after a while you play another piece of music. So the group spirits themselves are going through a parallel evolution that while all the conditions of the earth are changing, it's happening right now, there's less and less oxygen all the time. Lightning strikes, oxygen gets fixed to nitrogen, hydrogen floats away, never to come back, and the earth is getting drier and drier. So even the elemental forces, like the forces working in lightning and chemical fixation and things like that, even they are causing a change in the cosmos so that it's never ever going to be the same. So this is going on parallel on all levels at the same time. And it's something that's very, very universal. The Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that each human is a kingdom or a species unto itself. Not all, not Homo sapiens, but each individual is a kingdom or a species unto itself. By this, it is meant that we have a selfhood, and that selfhood is a focus. It is a miniature of the universal self that is the universal spirit, God, if you like, and that self focuses into its vehicles of consciousness. Physical bodies, etheric bodies, or desire bodies. And in that focus, because our selfhood is in the realm of universal ideas that are true throughout the universe, even the three-dimensional universe, if that's all you think of, but in a multi-dimensional universe, we are part of that. And when you have an indwelling spirit, this means that everything that is in the entire cosmos is within every human being, even though our vehicles may be limited as far as our ability to express it. This is why we're all kingdoms unto ourselves. we've all had different experiences from past lives and things like that, and that makes us each unique. But we're also unique because each of us has a viewpoint on the cosmos that is completely unique to ourselves alone, or to ourself alone, probably a better way of saying it. Get a little sloppy grammar every now and then. Now, because each of us is a universal, each of us can stand on our own spiritually. Will gave a very nice talk this morning about self-reliance and about standing on our own and having a positive attitude so that all of those things can really come through us. But this doesn't mean that because we're unique, it doesn't mean that we don't have a mood. It means that our mood is a miniature of the mood of the cosmos. We haven't come to that. That's what we're going to spend a lot about on tomorrow, that the cosmos itself, in the greater desire world, the macrocosmic desire world, it has a mood that is all of its own. We're all part of the same one. We're all part of the same universal spirit. And we're all working together, and we're all creating, and we're all part of it. We're each working out our detail, or we're each working out our point of view. And astrologically, that's very important. It means that when we work with astrology, we have to work with the whole. Not just one little aspect of the whole, we have to be in touch whole psyche, the whole soul of the individual as it's manifest in the world. We're all made of the same stuff, in the same desire world, in the same material world. An atom that might be in my dense physical body might at some other time be in your dense physical body. That really clarifies the verbal times. And we've been sharing the same atoms. That's even more intimate than sharing a toothbrush. But at any rate, all right. If we work with astrology, we must work with wholes. Now, at this point, I want to do a little divertimento and look to the side a little bit. I want to clear up some things about misunderstandings. That are potential misunderstandings about astrology. The horoscope represents character, but it represents character in both a horizontal and a vertical perspective. In the vertical, Jupiter is the primary factor in the abstract mind. And Mercury is the primary factor in the concrete mind. And the Moon, Mars, and Venus are important in the desire body, whereas the Sun and the Moon are important in the vital body. And the Ascendant is important in the dense physical body. But that's not the only way a horoscope can be used. It can be used horizontally, which means that all of the planets, in a horizontal sense, are important in all of the desire nature. Not just Moon, Mars, and Venus, which we're going to talk a lot about, but all of the planets, even Mercury, which is quite mental, has an effect that is all its own in the desire world. In the desire world, you know, planet Mercury has a desire body, and it's contributing its part of the desire world just like every other planet. This is so because any given moment, like the moment of birth, is the same moment, no matter what perspective it's looked at from or what realm you're looking at it from. It's still the same moment. Now, a lot of astrologers don't realize this, but when they're looking at a horoscope, they're looking at it both horizontally and vertically. They don't realize that they're in touch with higher worlds and worlds behind worlds, but they take it for, you know, they just take it for granted. Now, there are other factors in the desire world that are not exactly astrological, at least not in horoscope astrology. In a cosmological astrology, it is possible to know about them. But most astrologers don't work on that. I'll try to get to that now. I'm really having a hard time with my notes here. As we individuate and come into our own unique being, that is a rather paradoxical thing. The more we try to be like the one universal spirit, the more we realize, hey, we are one, the more the differences stand out when one looks from the material point of view. You look at people who are really spiritually developed, there's no doubting that they are who they are. And this misleads a lot of people. They think that the idiosyncrasies are what make a person unique, not that it's the universality that makes it unique. And so you find a lot of people, I was like that, I was a young phony. I was a beatnik, and I guess I'm eventually made it to being a beatnik, but for a long time I was a phony, and I was trying to do all kinds of unique things to be unique, and it didn't work that way. Now I'm trying to be universal, and everybody thinks I'm weirdly unique. it's that kind of irony that takes place. But our individuation, our coming into our own as individual beings, is very, very gradual. It's not the kind of thing like one day we're self-conscious, and one day we're not self-conscious, and the next day we are. It's something, there may be moments that we've been building up to for a long time where we suddenly take leaps forward in being more self-conscious. But for the most part, most of us are old enough to have gone through quite a bit of life where we can see that, wow, we're much more aware of things than we ever were when we were younger. And, you know, if you think of this over many lives like this, the individuation and the waking up to our individual reality is something that takes place all along. Now, before we had any self-consciousness at all, we were like the animals. There were group spirits and racial spirits and cultural spirits and religious spirits that guided us around willy-nilly, like a great big bull with a ring in its nose. Even a child can control it with that ring in the nose. And even after we began to individuate, we have been guided. Because a baby is born, we don't let the baby fend for itself. We don't say, all right, be self-reliant, kid. You know, it needs guidance. It needs care. And it's been like that with human beings. We take that baby and we nourish it, and we give it the guidance of various different kinds. Now, this is still the case yet with human beings, because we aren't strong enough to stand on our own. And even when we are becoming strong enough to stand on our own, we need resistance. So most human beings are guided more indirectly than directly. I guess it's sort of like a group spirit or a race spirit is sort of like being influenced by somebody's charisma. Whereas a group spirit, like of the animals, that's like being under hypnotic control, where you have no choice to do anything. But most of us are under attitudes, social attitudes, racial attitudes, religious attitudes, and such like that. We're under astrological influences. What I'm trying to say is that part of our mood, the mood that makes up each of us, has to do with religious spirits that guide us, because we're taking that in, and racial connections. You know, I don't know how to say it. I don't know if you've ever, I've seen it most strong in interactions between Jews and Arabs. And I'm not talking in the Middle East, I'm talking here in the United States. I have seen instances where very rational, very gentle, nice people, Jews and Arabs, meet each other, and suddenly something comes out of them that they're very antagonistic to each other. And it's a snarly kind of thing. And it does happen with all. Some are free from it. But I don't know if you've ever seen something like this. I'm always astounded at it, at how the people, they don't even know themselves. And they justify everything that they do. And very nice, gentle people. I used to hang around a lot around the student union, and I'd see it there every now and then. It would come out. I used to watch a lot of chess games and bridge games and things like that. And there would be competitions, and boy, but it's like you can see that some people are under that kind of influence. And if we stand up for our religion, are we under a collective spirit of the Rosicrucian philosophy? I think we must be, because otherwise we wouldn't be having as much politics in our organization as we do. If we were free from that, if we were individual and we didn't feel that we needed to have to defend something, which means that we need defense ourselves, you know, that's the way we see things backwards. But that kind of thing is there. Now, these are things that are part of our mood. And this, you know, if we think of our emotional makeup, for the most part, we can't see desires. And most people, when they experience desires, experience only the most exaggerated desires. Sex, anger, violence, going to a horror movie. But to go through very subtle, rare kinds of emotional experiences and have a desire that is completely unselfless, to sacrifice yourself for the sake of others, not, you know, most people don't have them. They're subtle. It takes a lot of self-watching and a lot of discrimination to know what your desires are, to be able to see into your own nature. And most of us do not know all of the contents of our desire nature. One example that Max Heindel gives, he says, is that some people are under the religion of the Holy Spirit. And the religion of the Holy Spirit is the race religions. But it's more than that. It's anything that brings someone to be an individual. The Holy Spirit is another name for the self. And the religions, the Jehovistic religions, bring us more and more to individuality. And that individuality is brought about by actions. When a person can initiate actions all on their own, they are an individual. And therefore, in the aura, Max Heindel says, if you like the phenomena, Max Heindel says that in the aura, the influence of Jehovah is red. Whereas the religion of the future is the religion of the spirit beyond self, the religion of the life spirit, which we know as Christianity. And therefore, Max Heindel says that the auras of most people in the United States are sort of a salmon color, that there's a predominant mood of the attitude between the self and the beyond self, between the Holy Spirit and the Life Spirit. On the other hand, Francis Tucker tells us that if you look at the aura of an adept, it's clear light, but that it is full spectrum. You have all the colors of the rainbow in it and many others. It's like saying this is a person that is freed from having to belong to any kind of specialized religious influence, and this is somebody that is so universal that all the colors are present. So these are things that you can't tell from astrology. So this, in what we're trying to do in the introduction to the relationship of astrology and desire, now you may be able to see that somebody has an inclination toward being a religious bigot, but that doesn't mean that they are necessarily more under the race-religion influence or not. It's something that is independent of astrological influence. I'll give you an example. Suppose you have someone who has Jupiter conjoined Venus, conjoined Uranus in the fifth house. Now, in the United States, that would mean somebody that had a very progressive education as a child, and that it would be very relaxed and easy. But it wouldn't have that interpretation in a society that had a strong race spirit. It might mean that they were beaten a little less than the other kids, but it wouldn't mean that they would suddenly be raised according. I saw somebody who had something similar to that, that was both parents were Freudian psychoanalysts, and the child was raised with psychoanalysis, and actually turned out to be pretty healthy as a young adult. All right, I'm way away from the notes here and just about lost, but that's all right, we're just about done. It's very obvious if you have clairvoyance that you can see if there is a general mood or if there's a general pallor. But even if one is not clairvoyant and you're working with someone, you have to be prepared to tune in on their soul nature in such a way that you are aware of what kind of an overall mood that is there if you really want to help them. The important thing is that there is a mood, and that mood gives a coloration. And that coloration is a different outlook on life from everyone else. And that, therefore, each person has their own psychology. You can see some of the mechanisms, so to speak, of that psychology in the aspect patterns, but you can't too much look at them like cogs on a gear. They are things that are precipitate within a mood. And so astrology has to be looked at that way. I worked with a man for years. It was really interesting. He had a very conflicted mood. He was very convicted of material science, very convicted, indoctrinated into it, all the way up to being a scientist, an associate scientist, which is, you know, it was the research equivalent of a professor. But at the same time, he was a very strict Baptist. Very strict Baptist. It was really interesting to watch with the man grew enormously, but to watch the conflict between his emotional relationship to religion and his cold relationship towards science. He had no unification. He could really value from something like Rosicrucian philosophy, but he was never going to get there, not with his Baptist attitudes. He looked at me as though I were a pariah, like I belonged not at all to everything. But it was really quite an interesting thing. And he tried really hard to intellectually fortify his feelings of faith. He read things like C.S. Lewis and Charles White and things like that, which are very intelligent religious literature. But it still didn't bridge the gap between the cold, hard-set materialism. And this was part of his mood. And it was a very interesting thing to look into. All right, I think we're just about ready to finish for today. The basic idea is that we are trying to look at the desire nature as a whole, and that all of the behavior that happens is only meaningful when behavioral characteristics are seen as precipitations out of the whole consciousness of the individual. When you find people who are not whole and that have such radical divisions that their connections between their activities are not meaningful, or at least not obviously meaningful, you have somebody who is insane or is on the edge of insanity. So the horoscope, in the same way that it represents the entire universe as seen from the time and place that this individual wished to commence a separate existence or a separate experience of the universe, is always universal. All right, what we'll do tomorrow is we'll look at all of astrology, and we'll look at the signs and the houses and the planets, and we'll look at them as parts of a whole, and that whole has a mood. For right now, we'll close with the Rosicrucian Student's Prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. I have one thing. I want to be particular. I'm one of those fussy Virgo types, and I'm strict about grammar sometimes. When we say the prayer together, it's the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts. The meditation is from the life spirit, and it is not pluralized. We are all part of the same Christ. We are all part of the same universal spirit. And I've noticed in groups over the years that sometimes there is a tendency to say the meditations of our hearts, which makes us, again, separative rather than unified in Christ. You had a question?
Yeah. You were, toward the end, you made a statement that aspects are like the cogs on a gear that are
particularizations, yeah.
Particularizations of a mood.
Yes, within a mood. Yeah.
Or within a mood. You might even say within a mood, within a mood.
Very often. But by the time you get to aspects deal with how actions are brought about in this plane. Now, if you understand it, try to imagine that you're a clairvoyant, and you have sort of a sub-mood, and that sub-mood, you know, like some psychologists call it a complex, and some psychologists call it a constellation, which is a nice word to use, that you get into a habit of feeling things a certain way, and that habit becomes a sub-mood. But that leads to a specific action. Suppose it leads to something like a nervous tick or something like that. The specific action, when you carry something out and finalize it in the world, it's always a potential until then, but when you finalize it in the world, it is carried out by a tool of consciousness. So the aspect, when it leads to an action, and the kind of action it is, and the tool of action that it is then not a mood. But if there is a complex where this, like suppose it's somebody that is hysterically emotional, that's a mood that turbulence may be there all of the time. That's a sub mood within the general mood of the person.
Yeah, what I was referring to, I accept that, but what I was referring to is when we manifest into this world, we choose a mood basically to come through to use.
Mm-hmm.
Within the macrocosm that has a specific mood at that time,
yes,
as well.
Yes, yes, yes. But for us, it's important that moods result in action, because in action is where we gain the experience. If there is too much of withdrawal in moods, that constitutes a neurosis where nothing is accomplished. And there's a withdrawal into the material world, and where we become comfortable here, too comfortable, but there's also a withdrawal from the material world that we never complete things.
Okay. But now, given that what I want to touch on here, what I want to get to, unless you were going to cover it another day, was that with the mood of the macrocosm, not man, but mood of the macrocosm. One of them has to be evolution. But you pointed, or you used one example of the depletion of oxygen. That has to be a mood at the present time.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
You know,
yes.
Things of that nature.
Okay. Yeah. But there are even macrocosmic actions.
Yes.
Like the mood that produces an earthquake,
yeah,
is where something has been carried so far, it's almost like you're pulling at something, and you snap it. You know, it's that there is that kind of, there are certain moods that come to actions in that way, and they usually come about with aspects. So you can look at an aspect as a character pattern. That, you know, this is their routine that they keep going through again and again and again, and it's a very specific pattern. But you also have to look at it as the means for bringing something to finalization, and finalization is what makes the difference between a cause and a consequence. It is when you have carried things out as far as it goes so that it produces an event. And for us, that event is in the external world, then whatever our dream or our cause was internally, when it gets externalized to being that kind of specific event, it is that's important. Because if you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, as the old statement goes, and you don't know until you have carried something out. Yeah. Yeah, but it isn't that. It's integration has connotes to me in the language anyway, that you're integrating a whole bunch of things into one, and not the other way around, that there is a one out of which all of these things happen. It's like Job of Fisk. Remember Job of Fisk in Little Abner? There's this man that always walked around and he had his rain cloud over him all the time. That was a mood. That was that person. There are some people, when they walk in the room, you know they're there.
So it's a good desire reaction to the incongruence that you have, or that, you know, I mean, I'm trying to just get a handle on what you mean by mood.
Well, listen to a piece of music. It changes moods, like as it resolves from one set of chords to another set of chords. But overall, a piece of music has a mood to it. It has a feel to it, and that is its being. And those little melodies or those little thematic developments can only take place within that mood, because they are logical to that overall outlook. And there are some things that if you feel a person, it is inevitable that certain things are going to come about in them. Like suppose somebody got a real snappy type of mood. That's the kind of person that's going to have an accident. Because there is, you know, Shakespeare has things in The Tempest, for example. There's a man that the ship is going down, you know, and there's a terrible, terrible storm. And one of the guys looks at the other guy and says, "No, we're all right. You've got the looks of a gallows man. You're not going to die at sea." And so he had the mood of somebody that was going to be hung as a dishonest type of person and not as somebody that was destined to be under the influence of the elements.
I'm going back one more to the aspects.
Okay. Yes.
So, say for example, you have a square aspect, Aries, to something in the fourth house or something like that. All right. You have it over and over in this lifetime, and it moves on around. It advances around the around the zodiac. But when it gets to the Pisces or the last degree of the zodiac, that's when it's going to snap. Effectively, is what.
I wouldn't look at it that way. You can look at it that way, and some astrologers do look at it that way, but I think that's too much of a materialistic way to look at it. Probably the way it snaps is, let me give you an example. It's from a man that lives in Ohio. I forget his name. He's a clairvoyant. And he says that in one life, you may think a certain way, and even this is too much, too easy, but in one life you think a certain way, and in the next life it permeates into your desire body and you feel a certain way, and in the next life you act a certain way, so that the thought becomes a desire and then it becomes an action. And if there was the original thought or the desire or along the way it was a misthought or a misfeeling, that when it, in the next life, when it becomes part of the physical body, it is an illness. And so that if a person has a life with many illnesses, it's like a big flush of the toilet. That a lot of thoughts that have been building up for lives are carried all the way out. And even if the person doesn't understand mysticism, or the reality that we are in, the spirit knows. And the person actually, if you go to hospitals and places like that, people say, "Why me?" And the only difference between them and us, hopefully, is that we're listening to an answer when we say, "Why me?" And so that's one way that things get finalized. It doesn't necessarily have to be with Pisces. Yes, to some extent, finalizations are with the watery signs, especially Pisces. But I think there are other ways you can look at it, too. Suppose a person is trying to deal with honesty. In one life, it might be intellectual honesty. In another life, it might be honesty of action, that you give something a clean shot, and that there is an evolution of that kind. But I don't think that kind you could ever find with the 12th house or, you know.
I'm not saying that it has to go to the 12th house, but you were talking about the stretched the part where it's stretched or stressed.
Yeah, it's.
And if it were got to 12th house, it'd be stressed to the maximum, and it would have to get.
It would be ripe to the maximum.
Yeah.
You couldn't. There are some moods that do not agree with the general atmosphere of the cosmos. And those moods, no matter how much you want to hang on to them, you can't hang on to them. If you try to hang on to them, it becomes nothing but sorrow. And with the 12th house conditions, that's something what it's like. You're trying to hang on to something that it's so overripe, there's going to be nothing but 12th house in that regard indicates a state of sorrow. All right, let's see. Rod is going to be on it to 4. It gives us a chance to cool the house down a little bit.